TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
End the sanctions on Iraq with Rania Masri. When I arrived early at the second floor meeting space in San Francisco's Mission District, the room was already half filled. This was the first meeting in the area to plan a huge rally in Washington, D.C. for August 6th, the 10th anniversary of the sanctions on Iraq. The effect of these sanctions on the Iraqi people are one of the better-kept secrets of our day. People react with shock and disbelief when told that nearly 5,000 children under the age of 5 die every month of malnutrition or for lack of medicine as a direct consequence of the economic blockade imposed on Iraq. These figures can't be brushed aside. They come from UNICEF, a branch of the United Nations. Supposedly, the sanctions are in place until Saddam Hussein is removed from power. The Iraqi people never chose Saddam Hussein. He was, in fact, supported and provided with arms during the Bush administration in order to pursue the war against Iran. Now the Iraqi people are being asked to get rid of someone whose dictatorial powers make that virtually impossible. The economic blockade not only locks out much-needed medicine, but certain foods, spare parts, paper, computers, trucks, chlorine for water treatment, fertilizers, etc., whatever the New York-based UN Security Council Committee that reviews the written application that the Iraqi government must submit for every item that gets imported under the Oil for Food program decides to disallow. In addition, without UN approval, US and British warplanes fly bombing missions over Iraq on average every 2 days. The airstrikes of last year, from January to August 1999, cost U.S. taxpayers over $1 billion. The blockade and the raids by U.S. planes have left Saddam Hussein untouched, but in 10 years, 1 million Iraqi people are said to have died as a direct result of what they call a militarized state of siege. Even former weapons inspectors such as Scott Ritter are now calling for an end of sanctions, moved by the dimensions of this tragedy. The meeting in San Francisco brought together over 20 faith-based church, human rights, and peace organizations. They committed themselves to getting the story out and to mobilize for the August 6th rally in Washington, D.C. While the front room filled with people in animated talk, I had a few minutes alone with a speaker, Rania Masri, coordinator of the Iraq Action Committee, and Nadia Babila. She works with the ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee chapter in San Francisco. Father Labib Kopti of St. Anne's in the Sunset joined us as well. He was the one who had invited me to come to this meeting. Here is Rania Masri.
Sanctions, it's a euphemism. You know, sanctions against South Africa. We have sanctions against companies that hunt tuna in the wrong way. You have sanctions, it's a euphemism. What we have against Iraq, in a legal sense, is an act of war because it is enforced by the armed forces. So it becomes legally an act of war. What we have in all practical sense is an act of war because we have more people dying every month from the sanctions than they had died from the military war and the military bombardment. And we need to understand that, you know. And we also need to understand what sanctions themselves are. We don't have sanctions. We have a blockade because it is enforced by the military, and we have practically a state of siege when we have nothing is allowed to enter Iraq without permission from a few white men in suits in New York City who dictate what is important for 22 million people in Iraq whom they don't even know and don't even care about. So it is a state of siege. It is not this, you know, light sanctioning or reprimanding of individuals. It is an imprisoning of a nation. And it is exactly what Dennis Halliday states, who is the former Assistant Secretary General to the United Nations. He has called this an act of genocide. And he uses that term completely because we know for a fact that between 5,000 to 6,000 toddlers, that is children under the age of 5, die every single month in Iraq because of this policy. So it becomes genocide on that aspect. And to prove it's genocide, you have to prove intent. And intent is clear, because when you know what your policy is committing and you nevertheless don't change your policy, then you are implying intent. So we have clear intention from the United States administration and its follower, the United Kingdom administration, that they are intending to kill the people of Iraq. So it becomes genocide.
And another point about intention is the infamous quote by Madeleine Albright when she was asked point blank, is the price worth it? And the reporter just listed all the toddlers, children, elderly, disabled, the weak of the population paying the price. Her answer was, it's a hard choice, but yes, it is worth it. That is clear intention.
You were just recently in Iraq.
I was in November of last year, of 99.
What did you see?
Very sad images. In addition to an incredible and resilient people, but I watched purposeful effort to suck the soul out of a nation, out of a people with such rich culture and history. I'll just give you one example. The richest hospital that's kind of based with a university, maybe the equivalent of Stanford Hospital here in the Bay Area, didn't have sheets for the children. They didn't have paper for medical charts. And when they asked us to bring paper, they asked us to make copies on both sides, because if one side is blank, other people will steal the paper for their school kids. In addition to not having the medicine, in addition to the children dying from leukemia and the cancer rates. These are just some other images that you don't envision when you hear about what's happening, what the effect is.
Do you have something to add to her story?
We know for a fact that the United States used depleted uranium against the people of Iraq for the first time in live combat. Now, what's really important to say is they did not only use this weapon as an experimental weapon so that they can sell it to other countries, which they have done, but they used it knowing full well what the consequences of the weapon are. They've known since the time of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima what the effects of radiation are. And they know when we look at the indigenous people of New Mexico, when we look at the people of Puerto Rico, when we look at other communities where there has been uranium mining, we know what the effects are. U.S. Army documents themselves state what the effects are. You will have a dramatic rise in leukemia, dramatic rise in other cancer rates, you will have an increase of birth deformities, you will have this radiation get absorbed into the food chain and affect what you eat and affect what you drink and affect what you inhale. We know this for a fact. And they knew this before they used the weapon. They used it nevertheless. They used it without telling their own soldiers. U.S. soldiers were not told of the weapon. They were not allowed to protect themselves, therefore. As a consequence, we have 50,000 U.S. Gulf War soldiers that have the Gulf War syndrome. That's 10% of all the soldiers that were there. The Iraqi people not only are now facing the radiation, the fivefold increase of leukemia for children, especially in southern Iraq, but they're facing this at a time when their healthcare system is completely collapsed, at a time when morphine is prohibited. Now, why in God's name would the white men in suits in New York City prohibit morphine from being entered into Iraq when morphine's only purpose is to ease the pain of cancer victims? We've seen an increase of cancer, and there's no morphine. There's very little chemotherapy medicine. There's very little medicine to begin with. So we have the United States deliberately use a weapon, knowing full well that it will cause these illnesses for generations to come. Then we have the United States deliberately withhold medicines and painkillers for curing. So when we talk about warfare on Iraq, we're not only talking about children dying from lack of food and lack of medicine. We're not only talking about not having enough paper and not having so-called luxury items. We're talking about your life and every aspect that you know, everything that you know, being taken away from you. Think about what you use every single day here. You won't be able to use that in Iraq. Just remember that when you go about with your day.
Do you have any other things to tell us about Butler? The American media is telling us that Butler is telling the truth. We don't know. Can you give us more ideas about who is Butler and what he is saying?
Well, first of all, Butler is a confessed racist. He went on New York Times magazine and New York Times newspaper, and he said, Arabs have a different perception of the truth. Second, and more importantly, he was paid by the United States and not by the United Nations. So clearly he wasn't working for the United Nations, but he was working for the U.S. administration. That is a violation of numerous codes and numerous basic ethics. Third, the allegations that he is propelling against Iraq are based on creating fear. They're not based on information. If you want to know what is happening in Iraq, talk to the weapons inspectors themselves, such as Scott Ritter. Study what is happening and think about it. A country that has been devastated by the world superpower and then having a massive state of imprisonment on it for 10 years, how in God's name could it pose a military threat? We have Israel, that is the sixth largest nuclear power in the world, as its neighbor. We have Turkey, that is extremely well-armed, that has been invading and killing Iraqi Kurds for 10 years. Those are the threats to the region. Iraq does not have the military capability to protect its borders. It does not have the military capability to even stop a coup if that were to happen. This is according to the weapons inspectors. So let's all keep this in perspective.
That was Rania Masri, coordinator of the Iraq Action Committee. Father Labib Kopti asked the question about Richard Butler. Now it was time to join the meeting in the front room, and Rania took charge.
We're here to work together to get each other's ideas, to learn what we all are doing so that we can be able to do it more effectively. Before we give you all the floor, I just want to talk a little bit about some of the main myths and allegations that are propagated by the mainstream media, by the U.S. administration, by other people that are pro-sanctions and therefore pro-war. And the reason I want to talk about them is so that we can become better armed, if I may say so in a really pacifist manner, so that we can become better armed in trying to combat this war that has been going on for almost 10 years against the people of Iraq. One of the first things that we hear, and it's quite absurd that they say it this way, is that Iraq has the largest humanitarian relief program in world history, and it's operating very well, and we have the Iraqi government themselves that are the ones that are causing problems in the distribution of the oil for food deal, and therefore they are the ones who are responsible for the death of their people. We've heard that allegation so many times, and I just want to refute it very briefly by talking about the main points. Number one, to call the oil for food deal a relief project is absurd. It is not a relief project. It is the theft of Iraqi oil. And the oil for food program utilizes Iraqi oil and then only sends 63% back to the Iraqis. That's the top max that gets sent back as allocated back to the Iraqis. That percentage is not an open percentage that the Iraqi government can then have complete access for. There is an allocation of resources. X amount of dollars is put aside for the people of Iraq. The Iraqi government then has to submit a contract to the United Nations, a contract for rice, a contract for wheat, a contract for insulin. And then we have a few white men in suits up in New York City who decide, yeah, they need this. No, they don't need this. And maybe they needed it last time, but they don't need it this time. So what we have seen is that the Iraqis somehow don't need pesticides and fertilizers and herbicides. They don't need toilet soap. They don't need detergent. They don't need medical equipment. They don't need insulin. And they don't need morphine. And these are just some of the items that are continuously and regularly banned or put on hold by the United Nations Security Council Committee. Approximately $1.67 billion worth of goods is put on hold by the United Nations Security Council Committee, more specifically by the United States, that has approximately 1,000 contracts on hold. Second in line is the British with 100 contracts, and that's it. Nobody else is holding up any contracts. So when they call it a relief project, that's not true. When they say it is there to sustain the people of Iraq, that's also not true, because even if they were to get all the money that is allocated to them, which they are not getting, it would amount to $200 per person per year. $200 per person per year to give you food, medicine, fix your electrical power supply, fix your water power supply, feed you on your farms, take care of you in all aspects of your life. $200 a year. It's not enough. One other brief, myth that's propagated about the oil for food deal distribution is that the Iraqis are hoarding medicine. We've all heard that, right? The Iraqis are hoarding medicine. The medicine is there in the warehouses. We've seen it. It's there. Well, yes, it's there. But the refrigerated trucks to distribute the medicine are banned. The people who are trained in the distribution of medicine, most of them have left the country. The computers that are needed to inventorize the medicine are banned. So we have a much slower distribution of medicine. And also, we don't have equal medicine. When you have insulin and no injections, what good is it to you to distribute the insulin when you don't have the injections? And that is a very, very common practice by the Security Council Committee. They'll approve one part of a two-part package and deny the other part. Clearly, there's a problem here. That's just a little, you know, myth about the All for Food deal that I want to break. The second statement, and we hear pro-peace activists saying this, sanctions are ineffective. Everybody's been saying sanctions are ineffective, and they list why. Sanctions are ineffective, the regime hasn't changed. Sanctions are ineffective, the people are dying, blah, blah, blah. No, sanctions are very effective. The sanctions are doing exactly what they were meant to do. Exactly what they were meant to do. They were intended to cause this level of destruction. There is no way these sanctions could have been written with these level of rules and regulations without knowing what the consequences would be. I'll give you one example. This All for Food deal that allegedly was done, and we have to remember the All for Food deal is not a Marshall Plan. The All for Food deal was not implemented to improve the status of the Iraqi people. It was implemented to sustain the status of the Iraqi people. There's a clear difference. What it meant was that 5,000 children dying a month, according to UNICEF, is okay, but no more. That's what the All for Food deal does. It does not mean we don't want children to die. It means we don't want any more children to die. So we have to understand that first off. Amazingly public relations. Now, the All for Food deal itself states that the Iraqi government cannot utilize any of the money that, by the way, is held completely in a United Nations escrow account, but it cannot utilize any of this money to purchase locally produced products. So let's think about that. You have to purchase products made by somebody else at prices they decide, not locally produced products. So what is the direct consequence of this? We have Iraq that was once an exporter of wheat becoming an importer of wheat because they cannot purchase their own wheat, even if they could grow it, which is a whole other story because they can't. But they can't purchase their own wheat. So what happens to you as a farmer? What do as a farmer? You're going to leave your land and go to the city because you can't live off your land. Nobody can buy your wheat. What happens to that land? We've seen an increase of desertification. Fertile land becoming desert because there's not enough irrigation, there's not enough protection. And once you have fertile land becoming desert, it is extremely difficult to get that land fertile again. And I'm saying this as an environmental scientist. It is extremely difficult. But then the farmer, now you've left your land and you've come to the city. What can you do? You've become one of those internally displaced refugees, living in places that are so poor that literally sewage is running into your living room. Literally. And now you try to make ends meet. And your children will become beggars. Your children may even sell their kidneys to some of the rich people who are willing to exploit them. And that is what we have. And I cannot understand how that could not have been foreseen by stating that you cannot purchase locally produced products. So yes, clearly this is an intent. Clearly this is no accident. And if we are going to give the war criminals in D.C. and New York City the benefit of the doubt, which I don't want to, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt. They didn't know. They really weren't expecting this. Well, now they see it. It's happening. Nobody's denying it. It's been happening for 10 years almost. And what do we see happen in consequence? We have a tightening of regulations, further restrictions, further bombardment, further warfare. We don't see the opposite. So then, they know the consequences of their policy. They maintain their policy. They intensify their policy. If this does not prove intent, by God, I don't know what will. Do we really need them to say, we want to destroy the people of Iraq for us to believe that that is their intent? It is clear. So let us not say sanctions are ineffective. sanctions have proved to be extremely effective in destroying the nation of Iraq, in destroying every aspect of Iraqi society. If we're going to talk about weaponry, we've heard Iraq is a threat to its neighbors. The Iraqi government has used chemical weapons. And by God, you know, we are so pure here in the U.S. We've never used any such harmful weaponry here. Talk about the kettle calling the pot black. But, you know, they're a threat. They've used chemical weaponry. They are going to cause biological weaponry to all their neighbors. And, my God, they can even attack us here in New York City in Trafalgar Square, according to Richard Butler. Okay, that's what we've heard, right? We've also heard them say, well, if they don't have weapons of mass destruction, why don't they let the inspectors go and check them out? They're hiding something, right? Well, okay. The weapons inspectors were in Iraq for 8 years. The inspections were so intrusive that they literally went into monasteries and went into the bedrooms of the nuns to see if there were weapons of mass destruction in the bedrooms. They literally went into the universities and burned the chemistry books because knowledge is power. This is some of the stuff that they literally did. But for 8 years, they were there inspecting. And according to Scott Ritter, who none of us would really call a friend to the Iraqis, now, Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine, a confessed spy for the Israeli Mossad, has been saying for a year and a half, Iraq is qualitatively disarmed. Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction. Iraq has no biological weaponry, no chemical weaponry, no nuclear weapon capability. According to Scott Ritter, they don't have qualitatively any weaponry. He further stated, in an interview soon to be published, that Iraq's weaponry, even before the war, was pretty darn pathetic. Even before the war, it really wasn't a threat. It really just had a lot of rhetorical threats. But practically, it really wasn't a threat. Now, it's absolutely not a threat. So talking about weapons of mass destruction, they've been destroyed. But they're not talking about the destruction of weaponry here. What they're talking about is the destruction of the capability for the production of weaponry. That's something very different than destroying weapons. How would you destroy the capability for the production of a weapon? You would destroy universities. You would destroy every factory that produces fertilizers and pesticides and vaccines. And you would make sure that people no longer have the opportunity to think and to learn. That is how you would destroy the capability for the production of weaponry. You would make sure what George Bush Sr. said in 1990 would come true. And we need to remember the words of George Bush Sr. He said, and I quote, "We will turn Iraq back to the Stone Age." And his son will follow in his footsteps just like Al Gore. There's no difference between them. So we need to understand a few of that myth. And the reason that I presented these three myths is so that we can become better equipped to refute what numerous people have been saying. Oh, I agree with you. I'm so sorry that they're suffering. But please, you have to understand X, Y, Z. Whenever anybody says this, I present to them a little chart. Very simple. It's a scale. On one side, there's a child who's dying. And on another side, try to fill in your but statement. So the children are dying, but. So what can they put in to justify this death? In my books, there is nothing that would go on the other side that would justify this. Nothing, period. Even if all their allegations were true, which they're not. Even if they were, nothing could go on this side to justify the death of one child, let alone the death of 200 a day. 200 a day. And we're talking about children under the age of 5, according to UNICEF 1999 report. 200 a day.
That was Rania Masri, coordinator of the Iraq Action Committee and author of a chapter in the recent book, Iraq Under Siege. I took her aside and asked her advice.
What could people do who hear this?
We believe very strongly that there is power in the truth and that the truth will open people's hearts. If people's hearts are alive, the truth will open their hearts. So what they can do is basically this. Number one, always remember the people of Iraq. Remember that Iraq is not composed of Saddam Hussein, but it's composed of mothers and daughters and fathers and brothers and sisters. Remember that when you hear the media propaganda. Remember that first of all. Next, with that memory and with the understanding that it is the very innocent people that are dying, utilize that information, contact your congressional official, let them know that you, as a U.S. citizen, are opposed to this genocide and this warfare. Ask them to sponsor and to support House Resolution Bill 3825, which is sponsored by Congressional Representative John Conyers, the Democrat from Michigan. And what this bill does, it's a very slight bill. It simply says that now in the United States will be able to sell and to send medicine and food to Iraq. Very, very, very simple bill. But it's a start towards lifting the siege on the people of Iraq. Then the third thing that we ask you to do is pick up the phone and call your local paper. Call the San Francisco Chronicle, call the Chicago Tribune, whatever your local paper is. Speak with the editorial staff of your paper and the news editor and ask them why they are not talking about the people of Iraq. If they are talking about them, thank them, but in all likelihood they would not be. Encourage them to speak the truth about what is happening to Iraq, because they're dying because of what our own government is doing to them.
How can people get more information apart from hearing what you were just saying?
Well, first of all, there's a fantastic book that's recently out by South End Press called Iraq Under Siege, The Deadly Impact of Sanctions and War. Get the book. It's edited by Anthony Arnov, published by the South End Press. You can get it at every bookstore, including the mainstream large multinational bookstores. Just get that book. It's very informative, and it has a list of resources at the end. Contact those organizations. Another site is you can go to the Internet, do a search on Iraq. You will find iraqaction.org. You will find saveageneration.org. You'll find numerous other internet resources. Get in touch with us, and we will keep you informed.
The book, Iraq Under Siege, by South End Press, has articles by Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Rania Masri, Kathy Kelly, and others. The websites, again, are iraqaction.org, a site maintained by Rania Masri, and saveageneration.org. This site has detailed information on the August 6th rally in Washington, D.C., and how to become a lobbyist on behalf of the Iraqi people. If all this is hard to remember, or you can't write it down right now, go to TUC Radio's website for links and addresses for these organizations at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. A one-hour copy of this program with Rania Masri that includes a recent talk by Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness is $12. Call our toll-free number at 877-TUC-TAPE for a credit card order. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. Or send us a check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's $12 to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. I urge you to get the book or the tape and share it with your friends. The music is by Gia Sajdev. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.